This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. If you've never visited Lake Superior, you really ought to put it on your bucket list. It is awe-inspiring on so many levels, but it's also challenged. It seems pristine, but a couple of centuries of exploitation have taken its toll. There is a new book that traces the history of the lake and some of those indignities that it's suffered because of humans. The book's title is Sustaining Lake Superior, An Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. The author is Nancy Langston, and she joins us now via Skype. I was aware of a number of the problems Lake Superior has and is facing, but having the entire history of what we've done to Superior was really disturbing. But before we get to that, you live on the lake. Where and why there?
I live in Hancock, Michigan, and I moved here from Madison, Wisconsin, because there's a great university here, Michigan Tech, which had a new Great Lakes Research Center. So I jumped at the opportunity to live as close to Lake Superior as possible because I'm fascinated by the lake. For 14 years, I've spent as much time as possible on the lake. And I realized that the opportunity to actually live in the watershed and experience the changes that it's going through right now would really enrich my research and be a key part of the community I want to live within.
You say Lake Superior fascinates you. In what way? How?
It's the largest freshwater lake in the world, which is pretty astonishing. People see it as a very remote, untouched, pristine place. But what is so fascinating about Lake Superior is it is a place that underwent some very intense industrialization and changes in the 19th century. It was the center of the copper mining boom that enabled electrification across the United States. It was the center of the iron mining industry that enabled our incredible industrial expansion because it was key to the steel industry. It was the source of some of the greatest fishing, the fur trading in the world. It was massively changed by logging. And yet, in many ways, the watershed and the lake recovered in the 20th century, especially after World War II. So one of the great stories, I think, of the lake is not that it's pristine and untouched because it's fairly clean right now. But one of the great stories is that ecosystems can recover. They're resilient if we give them a chance. And so I think the conservation recoveries of Lake Superior over the past century teach us really important lessons now that we face the greatest challenge, which is climate change.
So you mentioned a number of the things that have happened to the lake. I want to go back to what I think is the beginning. The damage to the lake that started as early as the voyageurs who harvested pelts. What happened when they took so many beaver?
This was an ecosystem that was largely shaped by beaver activity and changing the flow of the water and absorbing nutrients and absorbing pollutants. So when beaver were pulled very quickly out of the system, the land lost its ability to assimilate and break down many of the pollutants. And people did not realize that what had really allowed the landscape and the watershed to be so resilient was removed very quickly when beaver were taken out.
From there, as you mentioned, forests were cut, mines were exploited, copper, iron, then taconite, agriculture, channeling streams, overfishing, habitat damage, paper mills, exotic and invasive species. Take your pick. I mean, what's been the most damaging to the lake?
I think it's impossible to say if any one thing has been the most damaging in the past. I trained as a forester, so I would tend to say deforestation really radically changed the watershed very, very quickly. But pollutants as well, the mass infusion of pollutants into the lake, first from local mining industry, and then more recently from global transport of contaminants such as mercury from coal burning, that both local and distant sources of pollutants have had tremendous impacts on the lake.
You talked about the 20th century recovery. This combination of pollution and exploitation seems to have gone in some cycles over the last couple of hundred years. What, if anything, did we learn as damage started to become evident in each decade that something else was affecting the lake?
Just because it's a really big lake, dilution is not the solution to pollution. We used to think that, sure, some of these industries could pollute, but since it's the biggest lake in the world, surely a few drops of contaminants wouldn't destroy things. And as pollutants actually accumulated, they bioaccumulated. So tiny, tiny low doses in the water, it turned out, could accumulate up the food chain until they became so significant in the large fish and in the people and the birds that ate that fish that those animals were at risk of extinction. So we learned that even though it's a really big lake, pollutants move in really complicated ways, and we can't just assume that natural systems will break down our pollution, that we need to restore health by restoring forests and by working together across political boundaries to protect the lake.
Today, we expect, when it's working right, government will protect natural resources like Lake Superior. Where was the government when companies were getting rich at the expense of damage to Lake Superior?
The state governments were initially really trying, but they had two different things that sometimes contradicted each other. First of all, their job was to protect water. Minnesota especially, but also Michigan and Wisconsin, really wanted to protect clean water for their citizens, because by the 19th century, they realized that pollution killed people. But at the same time, they felt it was their job to encourage economic development, because they also realized poverty kills people. So they were trying to balance these two dynamics, more jobs and more pollution control. And at times they recognize that sustaining forests, protecting forests could help you have both pollution control and economic development. But when they were faced with the challenge of controlling pollution from mines and paper mills, they often felt that they could just hope the pollution would go away and it wouldn't be very significant, so they could have the jobs without having to really wrestle with pollution.
So we have this legacy pollution. You quote Dave Dempsey, who many people know as an author and an activist. He said cleanup efforts, restoration, has been ultimately ineffective because of reluctance by politicians to break ranks with industrial interests defending the status quo. What kind of pressures are there against cleaning up toxic hotspots like the so-called areas of concern in the Great Lakes?
Sure. Dave Dempsey was referring to the Great Lakes Water Quality Act, which seemed like such an incredible possibility in the 1970s, where the two countries, U.S. and Canada, were going to come together to restore these extraordinary waters, all the Great Lakes, not just Lake Superior. But it turned out that the International Joint Commission, which was in charge of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreements, didn't have any political power to force the two nations to actually meet their agreements. Over and over again, the two nations said, well, we want to control mercury, but not right now. So the two nations ended up relying on so-called voluntary agreements. They said, we'll just encourage companies to take voluntary steps to reduce pollutants rather than actually forcing them to meet their obligations. Voluntary agreements only work when you have a very persuasive fine or when you have ways to force companies and industries to actually abide by their agreements.
Lake Superior is so vast, it's so deep, it's kind of hard to imagine it can be damaged permanently by the human activity on the edges, the shores, but it has been. But you also point out there are global threats. There are contaminants coming from other places, and we also have to deal with climate change. Could you tell us about some of these global threats to Lake Superior?
Sure. One of the key global threats are called the persistent pollutants, and mercury is a really good example. So we have some within-basin sources of mercury, the taconite processing facilities on the North Shore of Minnesota still produce a large amount of mercury. We have the technologies to get that out of the air before it eventually makes its way into the water, but the state has chosen not to enforce those requirements. The federal government was supposed to step in March of 2017, and Pruitt and Zinke just decided not to actually enforce those standards. So we know how to do this. We have the laws, but they aren't being enforced. But the biggest source of mercury in the basin is actually coming from coal combustion. And coal combustion, of course, is also one of the key sources of climate change. And so the simple, most effective thing we can do right now to protect the Great Lakes and Lake Superior in particular is simply move beyond coal, use other technologies that are much less damaging. And this requires action on the global level as well as on the local level. But it's of key importance for local communities because 10% of human babies born in the Lake Superior watershed at the moment of birth have toxic levels of mercury already in their blood. And that profoundly affects their development, their ability to live full, healthy lives. And so we need to act globally as well as locally to reduce these threats.
What's your hope for the future of Lake Superior?
We move beyond coal, that we restore and help restore the resiliency of this world's largest lake. Nothing in the future is going to be as important as clean water and healthy ecosystems. We rely on clean water for every single thing we do. And this is the largest warming lake in the world and the head of a basin that provides 21% of the world's fresh water. The Great Lakes are an extraordinary global resource, and it's up to us to actually protect and restore them. So my hope for the future is that we come together across political boundaries, we continue the restoration of toxic sites. We actually see Republicans as well as Democrats right now across the Great Lakes really standing up for continuing the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative that was started more than a decade ago and needs to continue to have hope for the future.
Nancy Langston is a professor of environment history at Michigan Technological University. The book is Sustaining Lake Superior, an Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World, published by Yale University Press. Thanks very much for telling us about Lake Superior.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.